The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, December 29th, 2017. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. It is our famous, famous best of week on the Majority Report. Best of 2017. Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to be playing every hit. Countdown, 1,000 top rock and roll hits. We are now on Stairway to Heaven, number 76. Wait a second. Sorry. Wrong copy. I'm doing a little moonlighting. I don't know.
I'd love to produce a rock and roll show.
Dude, we could do that. It's not off limits. Ladies and gentlemen, on today's program, a best of from 2017. This one was back in August 1st. Wow, was it? Wow, God. Time is totally dilated. Naomi Klein, author, writer. She made a film, The Taking. I think it was called The Taking. It was definitely worthwhile watching. She made that with her husband. Writing in response to Donald Trump, no is not enough. Resisting Trump's shock politics and winning the world we need. I've interviewed Naomi Klein many, many times over the years. She's a very smart talker and writer. She discusses basically the response that we need in an era of Trump. And really, you know, I think we learned by the end of 2017 that Trumpism is Republicanism, is Trumpism is Republicanism. There is a, it comes in a slightly different package. It feels, maybe smells a little bit different, but more or less, we're talking about the same thing because everything's different, right? Mitt Romney Republicanism is slightly different from Paul Ryan's Republicanism is slightly different from Mitch McConnell's Republicanism is, at the end of the day, not that much different from, I don't know, Louis Gohmert's Republicanism, because the bottom line is they share the same voters. Some may be sincere about it. Others may be just pursuing political power and need these people. But at the end of the day, you're talking about politicians. There's no real material difference between one that relies on the votes of those people and the other that relies on the votes of those people. The programmatic differences are virtually nil. And they've always been virtually nil. So here's Naomi Klein speaking about that and what we need in this Trump era. Also, Matt has some of the best of the Fun Half stuff. And it is fun. It is so fun. I don't even... what would you say?
I won't include a clip that I don't laugh at in the research for this Fun Half selection.
Whoa.
I've got a lot to pick from.
Watch out, folks. This is going to be... buckle up, as they say. All right, here's Naomi Klein. We will be back live on Tuesday of next week. On Monday, it's New Year's Day, but I think we're still going to put up a show. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And here is, and then Naomi Klein will follow. Don't forget, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to this program the best-selling author of No Logo, Shock Doctrine, This Changes Everything, Naomi Klein, also now I think at The Intercept as well.
Yes.
Naomi, thank you for coming on. And author of, I should say, No Is Not Enough, which is a book that you published, you wrote relatively quickly, particularly quickly, relative to the works you've done in the past. Just let's just discuss that.
Sure. Yeah, I'm actually a pretty slow writer when it comes to books. It usually takes me about 5 years, and I somehow managed to write this, including the editing, in 5 months because I was in something of a frenzy, wanting it to come out. And also, you know, for my previous books, I generally had a pretty steep learning curve going into an area that was new to me for each of the books that you listed. So it's kind of like getting a PhD in a new subject for each one. But for this book, I was able to draw on, you know, 20 years of research and just focus on the writing.
Yeah, I mean, that was we were saying before we started, it so much of what you had written about in No Logo, and I imagine, you know, when we first interviewed you back in 2004, Janine and I on Air America, we probably talked about it that time as well. Came flooding back to me as I'm reading this because you're drawing on that, and of course this is also a bit of a how-to guide in terms of preparedness, and you're talking about these issues that I think particularly plagued me in the months following Trump's election. Things have gotten a little bit more, I've been a little bit more distracted from those essential questions, but they've returned. But let's start with your discussion of how Trump won by becoming this ultimate brand. It builds on the work that you did in No Logo, talking about the transformation of brands from sort of representing what they made to sort of an emotion that can be applied in different areas.
Exactly. So, I mean, marketing has always been about emotion and selling, to some extent, ideas. It comes out of the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, where, you know, people used to buy their core products from people they knew and trusted, you know, whether it was whether it was scooped out of a barrel in a local grocery, or whether they bought their food from a local farmer. They had relationships of trust, right? So when mass production was introduced, suddenly people are buying products without those relationships of trust. They're coming from factories far away. And so that's when you saw the first brands like Uncle Ben's and Aunt Jemima, and they're designed to replicate those human relationships, right? So it's these comforting sort of down-home figures, right, that are being substituted for actual relationships. And yet, these companies behind these brands are first and foremost manufacturers. They are manufacturing these products that they are then branding and then buying advertisements to tell customers about them. What I was writing about in No Logo almost 20 years ago now was this shift that happened in the 1990s when that kind of marketing was no longer working. Consumers were no longer willing to pay the kinds of premiums that they used to just for a brand name product. And so companies needed to dig deeper. So this is when we started to see the rise of what came to be called the super brands, which was a term first applied to Michael Jordan. These are companies like Nike and Starbucks that announced that they are not about the products. They are not manufacturers. They're first and foremost about the creation of ideas, the manufacture of ideas and lifestyles, which they can extend into a huge number of products and build these kind of self-enclosed cocoons. The ultimate, I guess, expression of this when I was writing No Logo was Disney built its own branded town. Remember Celebration, mm-hmm. Florida, yes. Right? Which is this fully branded town, and in many ways the ultimate expression of how you can build a self-enclosed lifestyle around a brand. And Donald Trump used to be a guy who built buildings, but after The Apprentice, he embraced this model of the hollow branded company that really doesn't care who manufactures their product because they see their act as of their act of creation being the creation of an idea. So Trump started to do that with all of his spin-off products, his water, his ties, his suits, and all of that. But then increasingly just started leasing the Trump name to developers around the world. He's not building those buildings, as we know. He's just selling his name. And I think that all of this is important in terms of understanding the relationship that he has with his base and also the depths of the conflict of interest between his presidency and his business holdings. Because just by being president, I mean, yes, there are active conflicts of interest that are taking place, but the mere fact of being president is massively inflating his brand and allowing his sons to be out there selling the Trump name for a great deal more because they are now selling the brand of the president of the United States.
And theoretically, I imagine, too, you know, some measure of access, particularly when you have an administration that seems to be so, I guess, unprofessionalized or so unsystemic, right? That the idea that Eric Jr. can call up dad and say, hey, do X, Y, or Z, and it gets done because they're going to operate that way. But so what is...
No, and I mean, I think one of the things that's really corrosive about all of this, right, is that what they are selling is less, you know, memberships and golf clubs, although there's some of that, right? Because Trump does still own a few flagship properties. And, you know, we know that membership fees have gone up at Mar-a-Lago and so on. And we know that Ivanka's company claims that their sales are up. But the part that worries me more in terms of the opportunities for corruption is just that when the Trump sons are out there selling developers the name Trump, right? It is a product that is completely ephemeral, right? So who's to say what the true market value of the name Trump is to somebody putting up a condo tower or, you know, a hotel? It could be 10 million, it could be 15 million. And if they do pay 15 instead of 10, you know, and the truth is, the Trumps have collected much more. We don't know exactly how much because of the lack of transparency, but we know that, you know, one development in Panama apparently has gotten them somewhere around $50 million just in leasing. So if a developer throws in an extra $5 million to buy the Trump name, it's very hard to know why they did, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, the Trump sons can just say, well, that's the market value. That's what it's worth. But this developer may have other things that they want from the U.S. government, and paying an inflated price may be deemed worth their while. So there's just endless opportunities for greasing in there.
And I mean, it seems to me it also, though, undercuts the entire way. I mean, I think there's always been this sort of a measure of corruption, but things become so quid pro quo-ish, right? That, I mean, I just keep thinking about this guy, Bukis, who's the CEO of Time Warner, I think it is. And in December, he was asked a question at some tech thing on stage. Are you afraid of Donald Trump, because he owns CNN, are you afraid of Donald Trump in terms of free speech? Because he's been attacking reporters at CNN. And his response was, no, I'm not worried about Donald Trump. I'm really worried about the Democrats with their whole Citizens United thing. That seems to me very dangerous. And of course, this guy is saying that because he has a massive merger, you know, in front of the Justice Department, in front of the FCC, the FTC, all of them. And there's this sense of like, we're just doing business on, like, you know, a handshake here quality type of situation. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, you know, we're seeing the destruction of those sort of like even tenuous norms that we have in this country.
Well, it's interesting. And I mean, it's also the way in which foreign governments watching Trump at understanding how transactional he is, right? And this is, he boasts about this all the time, right? I mean, this is what he means by how he's going to get a better deal out of every situation, right? And so even if they're not asking for things, foreign governments infer what the Trumps would like, right? So three labor monitors in China who were looking into Ivanka's factories suddenly are arrested, and the organization that they work for says this has never happened before. This is not just like routine labor harassment in China. This they believe that they were targeted because they were investigating a factory that produced goods for the president's daughters. Now, that is a service, one could argue, that the Chinese government is providing to the president's family, getting rid of the people who are blowing the whistle about the absurdly low wages, abusively low wages that workers are being paid to make Ivanka's stuff. Now, they can turn around and go, oh, we abhor this. You know, we don't want this.
Right.
But they are looking at this family and how they work and going, this will be appreciated. I mean, it's interesting, in Canada right now, there's a debate going on, believe it or not, over the fact that Justin Trudeau is on the cover of Rolling Stone right now, and the tagline is, you know, why can't he be our president? And the conservatives are attacking Justin Trudeau for having done that interview because they believe that this will damage Canada's NAFTA negotiations because
right.
it will hurt Trump's ego. I mean, how crazy, but this is how the world understands Trump, and they're not wrong.
And they're not wrong. That's the crazy part. And so, all right. So getting back to Trump's brand, like, what was Trump's brand? I mean, you know, obviously it's gold lame, but it's more than that.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, this is what's different than what I was writing about in No Logo, was the first stage of these lifestyle aspirational brands that were selling an idea as opposed to a particular product, a lifestyle, was most of them were tapping into kind of progressive values, really. Like Starbucks would say, you know, our idea is the idea of the third place, not home, not work. It's community. It's the coffee house culture. You had Nike saying that they were about the idea of transcendence through sports. And then, you know, Disney, family values, all of that. I think what really sets Trump apart is not the business model, because he embraced this similar business model. You know, you could compare him with Richard Branson very well, who also runs a, you know, very strangely structured, very opaque business set of licensing deals. But with Trump, the difference is that he built a brand around this completely amoral idea of essentially impunity through wealth. His brand is being the boss who can get away with whatever he wants because he's so rich. So it is just the dream of being the winner in an economy that is rapidly stratifying, and it's the world of winners and losers. So that's why the signifiers of his wealth are so incredibly important to building his brand, and that's why The Apprentice is the gift that keeps on giving, because it was just, he was paid rather than paying for the marketing. And it was the endless loving shots of these signifiers of vast wealth, right? The private jets, the helicopters, all the gold. It's why he makes sure there's, you know, gold curtains close to him whenever possible and so on. But it's not, you know, his brand is not just wealth. It's the impunity, the absolute power that comes with that wealth. That dream is what he's always sold.
Everything was geared in that show to putting him on a pedestal. I mean, just even the way they would stage it, where the, you know, the 8 or 10 people would walk in sort of subservient to him, and he would have two people to his left and to his right, you know, sometimes Ivanka, I guess, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly, and all to make him look like he's sitting on a throne, more or less. And my theory was, too, during the Republican primary, was that this was going to be very effective, because part of the conservative and Republican ideology has been that there is a moral righteousness to you that your money manifests.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're poor, there's something wrong. You've done you're it's a sign of a moral reprobate. And if you're rich, it's a sign of just the opposite. And so there was nothing.
And wisdom.
and wisdom. And so there was nothing anybody on that stage when he's debating them could say that wasn't literally trumped by the fact that he was richer than them, or at least appeared to be. And good.
But, you know, the only thing I would add to that, Sam, is that I don't think this is just about Republicans. And, you know, it is true that it's sort of the worship of wealth for its own sake, right? And this sort of the wealth creators, the job creators frame that the Republican Party had embraced pre-Trump. Trump was able to cash in on, right? And it made it very hard for them to challenge him. But at the same time, you know, I think part of the way in which the road was paved for Trump was by liberal figures like, you know, Bill Gates, mm-hmm. Bloomberg, and the whole sort of structure of the Clinton Global Initiative, which was this sort of kind of speed dating between issues, needing money, and billionaires needing reputational cleansing, brokered by Bill and Hillary once she was out of the State Department. And what this did is it reinforced this narrative that problems that we used to tackle collectively through democracy, like failing school systems, pandemics, were now just going to be solved by benevolent billionaires, right? And that, you know, if you think about the amount of power that a figure like Bill Gates has over the U.S. education system right now, or over African agriculture, it is enormous. And you know, even though that politically he may be very far from Trump, I think that, you know, a decade of reinforcing that narrative,
right,
that because somebody is rich and because somebody is smart in one area, you know, good at software, good at building buildings, that you can therefore transfer that to expertise in any area. And so I don't think we can just pin this on Republicans. I think this has been part of very much a liberal idea as well.
And I mean, the idea of inviting Michael Bloomberg to the Democratic National Convention, I mean, there's really no other logic to it other than he's a billionaire. And I guess, you know, Mark Cuban was you know, so closely associated too. Like, we're going to bring our billionaire, as if that is the terrain to fight upon. All right, so.
And one of the reasons I wanted to bring it out in the book, right, is because I do, you know, there's certainly signals that Mark Zuckerberg is sending that he's interested,
yes,
in being the liberal billionaire savior in the electoral sphere. And, you know, there are folks out there who are saying, well, we need to run Oprah against Trump, you know, our billionaire brand against their billionaire brand. And, you know, I don't think I don't think that's the way to go.
Yes. Well, we agree on that. So let's move into and I want to get to climate. I had a call on the program today, and we're pre-recording this, but I had a call on the program today and saying, you know, we got to remember to keep climate in the forefront. Mm-hmm. And it seems that it seems in many respects that we are significantly further from, particularly in this country now, from the levers which could impact it. Because we have a climate change denier in office who is really sort of isolating this country from the rest of the world in that regard. I guess the question is, maybe this is earlier than I wanted to get to this, is you know, how we can impact that. Maybe let's put a pin in that for one moment and just go to this other question that I think really dogged me following the election. When we had figures like Bernie Sanders and even Chuck Schumer to some extent saying, you know, we'll work with the president on infrastructure and whatnot. And there was a question of, do you fight the authoritarian impulses of a Trump administration? And I feel like this week we see that, you know, it really comes into relief with the speech to the Boy Scouts, with the speech in Youngstown about immigrants, you know, cutting up women, you know, beautiful 15-year-old girls, and, you know, the question of him perhaps firing Mueller. Do you fight those authoritarian impulses or do you spend your time trying to fight for issues like, let's say, you know, Steve Bannon, apparently it's reported today, wants to regulate Google and Facebook like utilities. Now, I think that's a great idea. But is there a danger that if I was to support those policies, and by I meant we, support those policies, that in some way we're empowering Trump, and in the event that there's another 9/11 attack, all those authoritarian impulses, the work that we've done to promote certain sets of policies actually increase his ability to engage in very harsh authoritarian moves and destruction of my,
I mean, I sometimes think that when we hear that from Bernie Sanders, that he's willing to work with him, that it's more rhetorical,
right,
than it is something that would actually happen, because the way Trump will invest in infrastructure is so different.
Absolutely.
Than anything that progressives can stand behind, right? That it will break down really quickly. Like, I mean, look, I think NAFTA should be renegotiated too.
Right.
But the way I would renegotiate NAFTA and the way Trump is going to try to renegotiate NAFTA are completely different. He is going to make it worse. His commerce secretary has openly talked about using the so-called best practices from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, mm-hmm, and getting them into NAFTA. They want to make it harder for governments to appeal rulings and easier for corporations to do so, right? So it's upside down of how we would do it. On infrastructure, you know, it's clear that their first major infrastructure announcement was about privatizing,
right,
air traffic control. They're already making noises about repealing Davis-Bacon so that the work that is created in infrastructure doesn't pay the prevailing wage or living wage, right? I think it's dangerous to do anything to prop up Trump's positioning as a savior of the working class. I really do. And I think that's a huge mistake. And I think we saw that huge mistake on his first day, you know, in the White House, his first Monday at the White House, when several leaders of trade unions in the building trades,
right,
you know, lavished praise on him. I think that was a shameful, shameful moment in trade union history. It breaks the most basic principle of solidarity. I mean, when immigrant workers across the country are being targeted in fear, you know, for their lives because of what Trump is doing, to praise this guy to the skies is deeply ugly and plays into some really ugly history of unions throwing workers of color under the bus, a history that should never be repeated.
And, you know, I mean, I think to a large extent, That concern that I had in those, you know, sort of as he was president-elect, were quickly dispelled as it became clear to people across the board that in fact, when he talks infrastructure, it's going to be, I mean, because there was this notion supposedly out there that, you know, Trump was not necessarily consistent with the worst of Republican policies. And he clearly, I mean, to the extent that he has any policies, I mean, he clearly hasn't operated that way. And you see Bannon start to announce this stuff. Like, I mean, he's clear. Bannon is making an effort at the very least to sort of, you know, change that and bring back some of that populism. You know, in the past 2 days, the same three people apparently have told Grimm that Bannon wants to raise the top marginal tax rate to 44%.
I mean, it's always difficult. It's really hard to know what to take seriously here, right, Sam? Like, I mean, it's projecting chaos.
Right.
But the timing of this is obviously really interesting, because with Trump attacking Sessions, this is infuriating the Breitbart base. So Bannon sort of trying, you know, there's various attempts to throw some kind of red meat to that base, right?
Yep.
The attacks on, you know, trans people in the military, other attacks on the LGBT community, and I think these signals, these sort of, I think I would be very surprised if much came out of them from Bannon is part of that, because I think they're scared. I think the Sessions thing is, you know, could potentially be a real blow.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, and I guess so. the tough part is just, you know, when you see, you know, there was Deborah, you know, I don't want to get into like the minutia of tweets, but Deborah Messing, mm-hmm. you know, wrote disgusting. The
yeah,
idea.
I saw that.
And,
yeah.
you know, which is, I don't. I made the point that I have a whole set of different sitcom people that are my political leaders, but nevertheless, you know,
I didn't get that. I saw that tweet and I didn't realize what you were referring to.
Oh yes,
I get it
that
now,
was a bit of a that was a bit of a subtweet, but the it's just it's very hard to sort of. You know, separate that. I mean, really, what I would have preferred Deborah Messing's tweet to be like, yeah, I'll believe it when I see it type of situation.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
All right. So the
but I mean, that also does point to the fact, and, you know, and this is, you know, something else that, you know, motivated me to sort of rush out this book, which is trying to put Trump in economic context, right? In that this guy could never have risen to power except in the context of a 40-year campaign that has waged war on the very idea of the public sphere and held up wealth as the ultimate arbiter of good. And he is the logical conclusion of all of that, of mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan saying the 9 most dangerous words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. He's all of that, right? And I think if we don't see him in that economic context, then we create a very false and shallow sense of unity within this thing called the resistance, where we tell ourselves, you know, we're all in this same fight, you know, with folks who think it's disgusting to raise taxes on the rich. And,
right.
And that's part of the problem.
Yes, without a doubt. I mean, that was one of my greatest concerns about Trump is that the nascent energy on the left. And it's,
yeah.
you know, we've been, you know, I think I first interviewed you in 2004. And I think maybe it was about the take, the documentary you and your husband did about Argentinian workers. And thinking about how alien that was, particularly at that time in 2004, of an idea in
yeah.
the United States in 2004. And now, you know, the needle has moved considerably, you know, particularly for people our age of in this country. It's never been this far left in the United States.
No.
And
no.
My, you know, the concern that I think coming out of the Bush years that I understood was like, wow, I was arguing alongside with people who have no problem cutting Social Security. And I'm surprised by that. And, you know,
yeah.
those people who I thought were my allies and so there's this sort of dual battle going on, right? Because you also do make the point that if there is a terrorist attack, we need to be ready to deal with that. And I guess, you know, the thing is like, I guess, you know, in the event that there is some type of shock, and this is where really the shock doctrine comes in to this book, that, you know, we still got to be, David Frum is on our side for that day, I guess. Right? I mean,
I don't know.
I mean, how do
I don't know if David Frum's going to stay on our side after that day.
Well, that's true. That's a good point of all people. But
maybe a better example.
Deborah Messing. I mean, I guess, you know, who is for what it's worth. But the point being like, all right, let's talk about that. I mean, preparing ourselves for that potential of a crisis, whether it's you know, one he creates by saying we're going to invade this country or who knows what, right? Russia shuts down our grid or supposedly does or whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, what worries me most is that so many of the policies that this administration is pursuing make shocks more likely, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whether they're deregulating the banks or the, you know, entire industrial sector, and a lot of this they're able to do without Congress, right? I mean, while everyone is saying they're not getting anything done, they're sure as hell getting a hell of a lot done at the EPA, which they don't need to go to Congress for. And it's getting almost no attention in the sort of daily barrage of I mean, there's just so much news, right? So it becomes a one-day story that the EPA is being dismantled. to a greater extent in the agency's history, which makes industrial accidents more likely. You know, we'll see whether they manage to completely get rid of Dodd-Frank. We know they want to, right? That makes financial shocks more likely. And the Muslim ban itself makes terrorist attacks more likely because it reinforces this narrative, this incredibly dangerous narrative that the U.S. is at war with the Muslim world. So there's a lot that they're doing that are making shocks, you know, without having to have a conspiracy, you know, to plan it. No, just what they're doing in order to enrich themselves, and you know, their belligerence makes shocks more likely. And you know, I think there's other things that they could frame as a shock, including civil unrest. But I was really keenly aware watching the response to the Muslim travel ban, which was, you know, exactly what we need to be seeing in terms of just the instant response and the fact that people were showing up for, you know, for others who, you know, who weren't directly affected. You know, I think it was real solidarity, not leaving this only to the Muslim community to respond to. But and so we saw that with people flooding to the airports. But I was very aware that is precisely the type of protest that if there was a terrorist attack in the United States or some kind of other civil unrest, then I think Trump would be very likely to say, well, this is a threat to national security. You can't block a road. You certainly can't block an airport. And you know, I don't know about you, but I was pretty aware that we didn't see the repression in that moment, right?
Yep.
I think that would change pretty quickly if there was a shock to exploit. So I wanted to try to focus people's attention on that and also share some examples of societies which have weathered attempts to use crisis to roll back constitutional protections, to impose some kind of state of emergency, and have come into the streets in huge numbers and defied those attempts. Because if it is just left to the people who are being targeted, if it is left to immigrant communities, if they're targeting, if they're targeting Black communities, then you know it becomes a lot easier to use extreme force. If there are millions of people in the streets representing all walks of life, it is harder to use extreme repression. Not to say they won't use some of it, but it is harder.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Trump administration was completely caught off guard to the speed in which people reacted to to that ban. I mean, the people were at the airport so quickly, particularly out in New York. I mean, it was pretty shocking. But that is in some respects is that not enough? I mean, you know, we have. I know that I think like Move On and Indivisible, I think have set up like sort of rapid response type of things you can sign up for in the event that, let's say, Mueller is fired I imagine would be used in other situations. I mean, we don't have a Secretary of State at the moment. He's on break, apparently. And that seems to me to also open up the opportunity for some problems. But what more do we need to do?
Which, in and of itself, I must say, like the fact that you feel better when the former CEO of Exxon is on the job, you know, just shows how much they've lowered the bar there.
I mean, well, but that's the problem, right? I mean, because on some level, you know, if it's not him, then it's maybe Jared Kushner. I mean, you know, it's possible that it's wholly irrelevant.
There are no good choices.
There are no good choices here. And that's the thing, is that each time, you know, people have this dilemma with, I hope Sessions doesn't get fired. I mean, I personally think he is horrific, and I would like him to be fired, you know, immediately, regardless of what happens after that. But I can understand the argument of people saying, like, but if Mueller gets fired, then, you know, if Sessions get fired. I mean, this is the dilemma you have with this.
Sessions get fired, and then Mueller gets fired.
Yeah, there's always this tension. On some level, right? I mean, you don't. It seems to me important to have mechanisms to have a State Department, and I don't. You know, I don't know that.
So, I mean, to a certain extent, right? I mean, there aren't good options, and there aren't going to be good options within this 4-year period, which is why the resistance has to be focused as well. I mean, certainly you have to respond to these daily attacks, there's no doubt. But there has to be a strategy for winning power and for for things getting a lot better once they're out of power. So I mean, this in those moments of shock, right? What I wrote about in the shock doctrine is that if there isn't a counter strategy, if there isn't a plan for how to resist, what happens is that each one of these shocks become moments when we don't only lose our civil liberties, they become moments for mass looting of the public sphere. And I began the shock doctrine with Hurricane Katrina as a sort of ultimate example of this huge traumatic event that was systematically exploited under Bush, but with a lot of help, actually, as it happens, from Mike Pence, who was head of the Republican Study Group, who was part of this effort to come up with this wish list of what to do in New Orleans and actually all along the Gulf Coast in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, privatizing the school system, creating a tax-free free enterprise zone, building more oil refineries. I mean, just the most bald opportunism, right? But the flip side of that is that these kinds of shocks that we're talking about, whether it is a market shock because they've deregulated the banks, or a major climate-related weather shock, or a terrorist attack that reveals how dangerous Trump's foreign policy is, if there is a bold progressive movement in that moment that has the guts to step in and diagnose the shock as a symptom of a failed set of policies, a failed system, and propose real solutions as a counter to that kind of opportunism, there can be huge political gains made. I was in the UK a couple of weeks ago and met with Jeremy Corbyn and his team, and it was really striking talking to them about the fact that during their election campaign, there were a series of horrific terrorist attacks in Manchester and London, and Jeremy Corbyn actually had the guts to break the cardinal rule and not just condemn the acts of terror, though he did do that, but link it with the war on terror, link it with the war in Iraq, link it with funding to Saudi Arabia. And rather than hurt him, it seemed to help him because it resonated with the public. And then put forward a set of policies, the Labour Manifesto, which was bold and resonated with the public. And he did much better in that election than anyone expected. So this is why no is not enough.
And the healthcare is perhaps one of those opportunities. I mean,
we're seeing that clearly. Yeah.
And so give me your sense of the strategy of winning power. I mean, what is your assessment of Bernie and sort of the resistance as it is at this point?
Well, it's interesting, just in the past few days, we've seen this people's platform strategy emerge. And that's something that, I think we need to see more of this. I think it needs to be even more articulated than what we've seen. This is a sort of a very short set list of more transformative policies, including single payer, getting to 100% renewables very rapidly, a list of bills that have been tabled and sort of strung together as a people's platform that was delivered to the DNC. I'm glad to see the gloves coming off a little bit. I think Keith Ellison's voice in the past couple of weeks has been terrific. This is something else that is really clear looking at the UK parallel, is that you've got to have the fight within the party. There isn't a substitute for really going there. And so electorally, there has to be a voice for that of a bottom up process. There's going to be a battle within the Democratic Party, depending on how it turns out. I think the people may leave the Democratic Party. I mean, if this battle is not successful to move the Democratic Party significantly to the left, I think there will be an exodus. But it's clear that people aren't ready to do that yet. They want to fight. And personally, I think it's worth fighting, considering how close Bernie got. and how shocking that was, as you said earlier, Sam. I mean, who would have thought a few years back that Bernie Sanders could have gotten 13 million votes and carried more than 20 states? He did do that. So, and he did do that in a campaign that I don't think thought it had a chance of winning when it first launched.
Yes, he did not think it did. I mean, I think that's beyond question, and I think. And part of the reason why I think, I mean, what is your assessment as to why he didn't get further even? Let's put it, characterize it that way. I mean, I think part of it is he got in so late because he thought he was just running a messaging campaign. But there were other issues, too, I think he had.
Certainly. I think it's really important for people who did support Bernie and do support Bernie to get out of the Bernie would have won tape loop, and look really hard at why he didn't win. And part of it is that, as you say, he wasn't running a campaign to win at the start. But frankly, I think a big part of it was a perennial problem on the white left of not centering racial and gender justice. From the beginning, right? So it's kind of like, oh yeah, we need to do outreach, you know, after it's already all figured out, right? And there was some important course correcting during Bernie's campaign, but I think that lesson that it can't be course correction. It has to be embedded if you want to build that broad progressive tent, which I believe is a majority. You have to get the temples right from the beginning. And, you know, one of the people who I interviewed for the book is Michelle Alexander, who wrote The New Jim Crow. And I think she's got the best quote in the book, which basically says, you know, if the left can't get it together on race, they better have Elon Musk on speed dial because we're going to need another planet. And this is not just, you know, this is not about pointing fingers at Bernie. This really is a perennial problem on the left. It's a problem at the nation. It's a problem, you know, it's a problem at so many left institutions. It's a problem at many trade unions. And we can't afford to continue to make the same mistakes over and over and over again. We now know that a progressive majority is within reach. It is winnable. So if it is winnable, we have to win.
And we should make the point that it's not just a question of rhetoric. I mean, it is
policy.
You know, it's policy, and it's you know, sort of the team building. I mean, I don't know how to articulate that. You know, he did not have the relation, and part of the problem with him coming in late was that he could not go and compete with the relationships that just the actual relationships that the Clintons had. Frankly, when it comes to particularly the African American community in the South, and those the tenor of those relationships would be different, wouldn't necessarily be with the same people in these communities. When Bernie Sanders goes in and makes those relationships, the relationships and what is supposed to come out of those relationships, hopefully, theoretically, is going to look different than it might with. With some without that sort of a set of policies, but you need to bring people, and particularly, I mean, obviously, it's Michelle Alexander's right. I mean, you cannot have a resurgent left or without a major amount of intersectionality. I mean, just in terms of actually,
Bernie would have won if he had been able to carry 50% of the black vote in key states.
Right.
So it can't just be blamed on the DNC any more than the DNC can blame the Russians, right?
Right.
For their electoral loss. There are a lot of women in my generation and older who have told me, and you know, these are not Hillary fanatics. These are people who wanted to support Bernie, but somehow felt that gender issues were tacked on, that there was a fundamental sort of not getting it about how precarious these rights are. It's about those relationships, and I think it's about really having a deeper story about how all of our issues are interconnected, not just a kind of a laundry list, but really a different frame about these deep connections. Because the right does have that. It's ugly, but they do have it. And unfortunately, I think on the left, we often respond with just a kind of a laundry list, a sort of checklist. as opposed to a different history, a different narrative of how we got here and where we want to go.
And to just, I guess, cap that off. I mean, at the end of your book, you talk about the Leap Manifesto out of Canada. What is that?
So that was an attempt, and you know, this is something I think we are starting to see examples of in the U.S. as well, but more at the city and state level. But what this was a people's platform that was drafted by 60 movement leaders. I was part of the process. We launched it in the middle of an electoral campaign, but ideally you would do it well ahead of an election and really shape the kind of platforms that get out there in the first place. It was endorsed by hundreds of organizations, signed by tens of thousands of people, and it is a plan. The catalyst for it was the climate crisis. It's a plan to listen to what scientists are telling us about how rapidly we need to get off fossil fuels, and listen to what the engineers are telling us about how it is possible to get to 100% renewable energy in the next two decades for electricity and for our entire economy well before mid-century. But the argument that we make in the Leap is that if we are changing the fundamentals of our industrial society, how we get our energy, how we move ourselves around, this is a once-in-a-century opportunity to close inequality gaps at every level and to begin to heal the wounds that date back to the founding of our country. So it begins with indigenous rights and a full implementation of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which says you can't have industrial projects of any kind on indigenous land without free, prior, and informed consent. But it really paints a picture of what the country can be, and it was a really amazing process to be a part of, because you know, when you build a broad coalition like that, when you bring together people in the room who don't usually get in the room together, like environmentalists and trade unionists representing energy workers and indigenous leadership and immigrants' rights leaders, you can't fall back on nostalgia. I think on the white left, there's been an unfortunate tradition to just idealize the post-war period or the New Deal. It's sort of like, well, we just want to go back to that. And when you organize with communities that were systematically left out of those leaps forward, they really don't let you fall back on nostalgia because they were never included in the first place. So it meant that we had to draw our inspiration from the picture of the world that we've never lived in, and so I think whatever happens on the electoral level in the U.S., there's nothing stopping these rising social movements that were rising well before Trump from getting together, and this is happening in lots of ways, to map out a people's vision of the world that we want post Trump, and to force whoever wants to take up the progressive mantle in the next election, whether it's Bernie, it's not just going to be, there are going to be many people vying for it, to really make them, I think, live up to the vision that is coming from below.
And do you see any, the People's Platform, I guess we came out just a couple of days ago, and sort of almost simultaneously, the Democrats offered their better deal, which was, a marginally better deal. Although there's a lot of people, and I'm one of them, who is pretty encouraged by the antitrust stuff, because it just suggests to me, at least, that they're at the very least searching around, right? Like they're listening to some extent. Was that your take on that as well?
They're inching in the right direction, and I think it's exciting that they're under pressure, and I think we should pause to just acknowledge that it's pretty amazing that people are managing to fight on so many fronts at once, right? I mean, it's really hard to be fighting these attacks from this crazed Trump administration, And at the same time, to be able to put pressure on the Democrats, I mean, that's an organizational feat that is happening in this country. And they're hearing it. They're hearing it on single payer. I mean, whether they've fully absorbed it yet, clearly not. But they're certainly feeling the heat, and that's significant.
That is the one thing in this fight that I think I've been very sort of surprised about, particularly coming out of, you know, getting more engaged during the Bush years, was that you didn't have a Democrat or two in the Senate who ended up, I mean, they were off the table for the Republicans from day one in terms of this repeal and replace stuff. And I, that was not something that, you know, I was a little surprised by that, you know, and I guess maybe my expectations had been managed by the years during the Bush administration where the Democrats capitulated as quickly as they could. And granted, it's a different dynamic, but that is somewhat encouraging to see them at least on their heels a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Naomi Klein, the book is No Is Not Enough. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about it today. I really appreciate it.
Great to talk with you, Sam. Thank you. Keep up the great work.
Thanks. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid. Before we go into the fun half, we have some pretty disturbing audio, I guess, that has been unearthed that I am not prepared to comment on at this time. But, well, I mean, I'm going to comment on it, okay? The fact is, Matt is always getting in my face about stuff around here. He is one of these one of these types of employees that always wants to go to the bathroom or occasionally wants to go to the bathroom and expects me
I think
as an employer.
Is fair.
Well, I mean, whatever. The point is, it's like it's always on me as the proprietor of this outfit to make sure that everything's okay. And so we had a slight altercation because he was getting too aggressive about things, and let's just play the audio since it's going to get released anyways.
Sam, did you order more toilet paper?
I'll get to it.
We're on the last roll.
Yeah, I got it!
Just leave me alone about that stuff.
You broke my Game Boy.
Yeah. Sorry about the Game Boy.
How many is that, Sam? Be honest.
Well, that's like the seventh Game Boy I've had to buy. And you
gotta
know what?
Take some accountability.
It's not easy to find them now. You gotta go onto eBay. Tweeted me and said, "Hey, this guy Gorka, he's not really a doctor like Michael Medved called him, but he did get a PhD, supposedly.
Indubitably.
The reason why I say supposedly is he has been touting for quite some time, for years, that he was an expert witness in the trial of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, the accused Boston Marathon bomber. But Fusion reports that based on an account of an official in the office of the U.S. Attorney in Massachusetts, Gorka never testified at the trial and prosecutors didn't rely on his expertise in preparing or presenting their case. In other words, he was not an expert witness. His personal website, The Gorka Briefing, which has since been taken offline.
Dude, can I just interject? For the first time of my life, I feel like we are collectively insulting Henry Kissinger.
Yes.
That this guy is like in that slot. It's so disrespectful to that old war criminal.
He used to have a section dedicated to his role as an expert witness in the Tsarnaev trial. This is based on an archive of his website. He claimed to be an expert witness in the case. For instance, in an analysis of the Tsarnaev verdict, in which he claimed to be an expert in a XM Sirius Patriot interview, as well as on the John Batchelor show. He's maintained his false role as an expert witness in the Tsarnaev trial on various platforms, where he claims to have served as an expert witness in the Boston Marathon bombing trial. That's a quote. Tucker Carlson introduced Gorka as an expert witness for the prosecution. And someone who was, quote, actually involved in the case. Yeah. He did submit a so-called expert report in the prosecutor's office, but that not and never actually appeared at trial. Now, I could submit an expert report, too. He was never called, and nothing he ever gave us was used, the U.S. Attorney's office told Fusion. So,
I have a PhD in geostrategic global landmass strategy studies from Trump University.
Well, but here is Gorka on
PRI with Marco Werman.
With a guy named Marco Werman.
Werman.
Werman, talking about fake news. Because he's an expert witness.
Sebastian Gorka, we're seeing huge divisions in the U.S. at the moment. How does the Trump administration plan on addressing those divisions, some of which have obviously come out in this interview?
By actually implementing the making good on the promises that the president made in his campaign. So if you look at what we have done in just the last 15 days, it's quite incredible.
That is assuming that those promises don't continue to anger large parts of the country who are still protesting and still very angry.
Go to Montana, go to Middle America, go to the backbone of this nation that voted in Donald Trump. I'm not interested in the chattering classes, in the social justice warriors, the people who are spun up and wear masks covering their identity, destroying other people's private property. The chattering classes of Los Angeles, New York, even D.C. and San Francisco do not represent the people who believe that America can be great again. So when you say large parts of America, again, I'd like to see your data because it's not true.
Sebastian Gorka, Deputy Assistant to President
Donald. Look at the backbone of this country, Montana, for instance, or other places I've barely been.
Look at places where they don't
allow black people into local bars, as an example. Or they have emotional breakdowns every time there's a new Mexican restaurant.
Tell me something. Have you ever driven a Ford F-150? Or perhaps a Dodge Ram Tough
Have
vehicle.
You ever murdered a hooker in a Grand Theft Auto game, as an example? Or you would SJW, W's. Who would ruin video games with feminist propaganda?
There are 68 million SJWs in this country. Who are anything but the backbone?
It was just like a month and a half ago that a bunch of Montana politicians came out and condemned Richard Spencer. So there are some SJWs in the backbone.
Totally not interested in a free, fair exchange of ideas. I don't think I care about some SJWs in Boise. You got to go to the more rural part of Montana where the real people live.
Yes, the chattering classes.
I'm interested in the chattering classes of Bozeman. Have you ever met Richard Spencer at a rest stop?
Are you aware?
The real backbone of America.
Are you aware that I have claimed to be an expert in the Saranov case?
I'm a walking insult to Henry Kissinger. He at least could get his way through a PhD that was real and
Pardon
credited
me.
Before
the
he became
backbone.
A war criminal.
The real backbone of this country wears this pin. Do you see this pin I am wearing on my chest right here? This pin is the backbone of the country. It's the Order of Vitsie. I don't know how to pronounce it. He does wear a pin of the Order of Vitezi. And the Order of Vitezi was established for Vitezi Rend, established by Miklos Horthy, the regent of the King of Hungary from 1920 to 1944. It was established for both civilian and military supporters of Horthy's government. Horthy opened this distinction initially for non-Jews who served in distinction during World War I. Now, according to Eli Clifton, although Horthy's personal views about Jews are still debated, he was explicit in endorsing anti-Semitism.
Eli Clifton is very, very judicious. Friend of mine.
Yes.
Yes.
As regards to the Jewish problem, Horthy said, I have been an anti-Semite throughout my entire life.
That's ridiculous.
I have never contact with the Jews. I have considered it intolerable. Here in Hungary, everything, every factory, bank, lodge, fortune, business, theater, press, commerce, one might say the chattering class... I added that, should be in Jewish hands and that the Jews should be the image of reflected of Hungary, especially abroad. Since, however, one of the most important tasks of government is to raise the standard of living, we have to acquire wealth. It is impossible in a year or two to replace the Jews.
It's not a particularly long
They have everything in their hands and to replace them with incompetent, unworthy, mostly big-mouthed elements, for we should become bankrupt. That requires a generation at least. So he was uncomfortable with the Holocaust, because he felt the pace was too much to sustain.
Far too fast-tracked. It must take long view. I did an article, or I should say, a bullet point map with a couple of glowy stickers on the long view for my PhD thesis in geostrategy at Trump University.
To be fair, in 1944, Horthy may have sought to distance Hungary from Nazi Germany, but agreed to deport around 100,000 Jews. So, you know, pragmatic.
I don't want to kill Mexicans. I want to deport them. The chattering class SJWs see no subtlety in these matters of great intellectual import.
Allow me to wear my pin. which was formed in celebration of anti-Semitism, but a pragmatic one.
A pragmatic one. And to quote the president, those guys did a tremendous job. Great guys, by the way. I was also involved in the OJ trial, and if they had called me to the stand, he certainly would have been convicted. He was part of a Jewish plot to overrun the country clubs of Beverly Hills. It's my book called The Real Jewish Factor Behind the Killing of Nicole Brown. But the SJWs are too afraid to touch this.
I do, honestly. I'm like, how weird is it that I'm like, dude, like, you had Henry Kissinger was like, you know, he knew what Laos was before he committed war crimes there, you know, like...
You basically just need the accent.
You just need the accent, exactly.
I have a sense I know who is going to be on that network is their terrorism expert. Because one guy who is not for long in the Trump administration is going to be the subject of this little piece. Seb Gorka was Bannon's boy. And in fact, when Seb Gorka was on the outs, all these reports that he was on the outs, Bannon salvaged him. They're going to try and keep him in there for as long as possible because they want the leaks from him. But, and of course, his wife is in there cutting off funds to the national anti-Semitism, whatever
After Hate, specifically. Yeah. It was a group founded by a former skinhead who helps take people out of that. I think it was $800,000 worth of funding that they took away from that group specifically.
Yeah, I mean, why would you spend the money?
That money is not going to communists.
No.
So here is CNN's report. And my favorite part about this is that you know, Gorka, when he had his PhD, had an advisor, and apparently Gorka made the mistake of not taking care of that loose end.
Gorka's start in politics began in his parents' homeland when he tried and failed to become mayor of a small town in Hungary. He then aligned with a radical ultra-nationalist leader to announce a new Hungarian political party that also failed. But his political ties have been the source of unfounded allegations he's anti-Semitic. CNN has found no evidence Gorka has ever held anti-Semitic views, but the allegation won't go away, largely because of this medal Gorka often wears. It was awarded to his father by a group called the Vitezi Rend, which at one time, the U.S. State Department said, was under the direction of the Nazi government. A current leader of the Vitezi Ren tells CNN they were never involved with the Nazis and says Gorka himself is not a pledged member. Sebastian Gorka says he wears the medal to honor his father. Gorka did get a PhD in political science from a university in Budapest. The dissertation he wrote to earn his degree has been called inadequate by several scholars. Professor Stephen Sloan, now retired, is a Gorka friend and was even an advisor on Gorka's dissertation, which he says was competent. Calls some of the criticism against Gorka partisan, but...
Sebastian is knowledgeable. I would not call him an expert on terrorism.
Sloan says he didn't anticipate Gorka's meteoric rise to the White House.
His level of expertise does not match the level where he stands in the White House.
Folks, just a little note. When your friends say, like, I never expected him to amount to something like that, and it's almost a problem, then you know you've got a problem. And I will say this, too, about that report that they said he never pledged. That is in conflict with the reports from what I think it was... Tablet, Mac?
The Forward, I thought. The Forward reported this heavily, and Eli Clifton over at Loblog reported this.
So maybe they've wised up a little bit and realized that, like, a man in Washington.
It's also funny framing. Like, I get that no one's made the claim that he said anything anti-Semitic, but it's just funny to like, it just keeps dogging him. This, and there's one reason why. He has a medal from a neo-Nazi group, but besides that, it's totally unfounded.
It's not even neo-Nazi. It's just Nazi group.
I guess
group.
It was like literally a Nazi group, but not a communist group.
We're just sort of like long tail Nazis.
Folks,
things have a second life in Hungary. He's like, I thought that he would be, I don't know, talking on the radio about why terrorists were bad or something, and the dissertation worked perfectly okay for that.
There's something about seeing him on mid-2000s Hungarian television that makes him look like Ricky Gervais.
Yeah.
Well, he's kind of like the mean-spirited David Brent of counterterrorism.
Yeah, David Brent, that's what I meant.
Yeah, he is the David Brent of security.
I thought he'd meet someone nice and settle down. I mean, he met a very wealthy woman.
No, so he goes and gives some talks to some old Kentis in Palm Springs that will scare them a little bit.
I really
and
thought
that's it.
That he had learned enough maybe to write a middling suspense book about terrorism. Yeah, that'd be nice. And he seemed to have a lot of friends in California, and I thought maybe he'd write like a little movie, maybe something for Hungarian television.
He had planned on retiring, looking at his father's Nazi memorabilia, but they pulled him back in.
Just then the helicopters just rung out from the distance and landed in his front yard and said, "We need you back."
Damn. More slinky Japanese woman to avoid cheating on his wife with.